Wisconsin has a rich political history, particularly when it comes to Republican Party politics. After all, the party was born in a rippin' Wisconsin schoolhouse back in 1854 as an anti-slavery party. Some years later, it was also the birthplace of the so-called Progressive Movement, led by Robert Fighting Bob La Follette. La Follette led an insurgent group inside the Republican Party, which eventually caused a split that put a Democrat in the White House for only the second time since Lincoln. Michael Woolreich is a journalist and historian who writes about historical events to illuminate modern politics. He's written a new book about the birth of the Progressive Movement titled Unreasonable Men, Theodore Roosevelt, and the Republican Rebels Who Created Progressive Politics. Michael Woolreich, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start between, put a little context here, because those of us who didn't study American history too closely or for whom it's been a number of years since the last time they had to pass an American history exam may not be familiar with all the players and so forth. Let's talk about the similarities between the politics of the early 20th century and today. As I was reading your book, I was particularly struck by a lot of the parallels, particularly the role of the business community, of corporate money in politics then and now. Can you maybe give us a little bit of context of the situation as it was when Theodore Roosevelt became president after the assassination of President McKinley?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I was also struck by the parallels to that time, and that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, to see what kind of lessons we can draw from how people dealt with the challenges of that era, which are actually very similar to our own. One, which was certainly corporate influence in politics. The process worked a little bit differently back then. They had there were political machines in pretty much every state, including Wisconsin. And the machines were run by political bosses. Now, these bosses would basically hand-choose which candidates their party would nominate, using their power over the party to do so. And they also had, there was also a lot of influence from industry. The bosses needed money to run the machines, and the businessmen made campaign contributions. And in return, of course, the candidates who won office at the boss's behest would do favors for the financial backers.
Well, I mean, there were places in the United States where they actually paid people to vote.
Yes, it's particularly in certain areas like Rhode Island, people would be reimbursed a couple dollars for voting for a candidate. In Wisconsin, that was not the case, because you had to have a pretty small. You could do it in the cities, but it was pretty hard to do statewide. However, the campaigns cost money then, as just as they do now, and there was also a lot of bribery. There was, this is before the primaries were developed, and so it was a caucus system, and the caucus delegates were often paid off by the bosses to vote for the preferred candidate.
So we had a situation where there was a lot of instead of corporations in those days, we had trusts. There were large conglomerates, which were you had certain individuals who were had a lot of money, and they bought up a lot of smaller companies and made them into one big company. These were called trusts. Teddy Roosevelt was called Teddy the Trust Buster, because he managed to break one of them. Although, as I read your book, my impression of Theodore Roosevelt is a lot different than it was before I read your book. I must say that. But there were these large trusts, and they were putting a lot of money into politics, but business in general, banks, railroads, a lot of other people were interested in making sure that the government, number one, didn't interfere with what they were doing, and number two, helped pay for it. Is that a fair characterization?
I would say that's very fair and exactly right. Theodore Roosevelt was, when he did mount a lawsuit against a big, huge railroad merger that would have consolidated much of the railroad lines in the United States, which basically enabling this trust to completely dominate ground transportation at the time. The one of the big players in that trust was the banker J.P. Morgan, with whom I think most people are familiar. The other big trusts were, for example, J.D. Rockefeller, Standard Oil Company. So Roosevelt was innovative in the sense that there was an old antitrust act, the Sherman Antitrust Act from the 1890s, and it hadn't been used to sue a trust before in this way. And so Roosevelt broke ground on this, but he wasn't quite the trust buster that he's known to be. He was, in fact, his successor, William Taft, who was much more conservative than Roosevelt, in fact, sued many more trusts than Roosevelt did. Roosevelt actually liked to use the threat of a lawsuit, but he preferred to negotiate behind the scenes and try to get the trusts to change their behavior themselves rather than actually suing them and breaking them up.
Well, we'll come back to this because it's a real important point in your book. But Roosevelt operated; he was sort of pragmatic. He believed in doing what you could do now and compromising to get a little bit of what you wanted, even if you couldn't get the whole thing. And that was kind of he might say one thing in public, but behind closed doors, he was going to support whatever he could get accomplished with the Congress that he had at hand.
Absolutely. He very much thought of himself as a practical man, as a pragmatist. He said many times he saw no point in pushing a radical bill that couldn't be passed. He had to work with the Congress that he had. He even, you know, before he became president, he even wrote an essay praising the art of compromise. So he was, you know, the sort of famous TR, the fighter that people remember was more than that. And actually, it would not be until later, after he was no longer president, that he really developed this reputation, this historical reputation legacy as a progressive fighter.
Mm-hmm. All right. So presidents of that day, and people may be really surprised to find this out, presidents of that day or presidential candidates didn't always get involved in party politics. In fact, wasn't it true that, I mean, presidents and presidential candidates didn't even go to party conventions? That was considered unseemly?
Well, so yes and no. They were very much involved in party politics. However, they had to keep an appearance of not being involved. So the presidents, it was looked down for them to show up actually at the convention. They were supposed to be above politics, and you know their deputies would do the work for them at the convention. And so, in fact, Theodore Roosevelt was the first president to show up at his own nomination convention, and it wasn't the Democratic or the Republican Party, the Bull Moose Party, the Progressive, another name for the Progressive Party that he later started. But when he was running for president, he did not show up, but he was on the phone, on the telegraph, hearing every detail and communicating with his campaign manager, who was at the convention, mm-hmm. Working it for him. So it wasn't that they weren't involved, but people didn't think they should be involved.
They didn't want to have the appearance of getting down into the mud of the political arena. They were
exactly.
Supposed to, by appearance, they were supposed to be above the fray. Okay, so let's, and I don't want to spend too much time framing this because I would like to spend most of the hour talking about fighting Bob La Follette, since this is Wisconsin Public Radio after all, and that is quite a bit of what your book is about, although he's not the only player certainly in it. The major issues of the day, they were primarily economic. We didn't have any wars going on at the time. We had emerged victorious from the Spanish-American War. World War I hadn't happened. There was relative peace around the world, at least as far as American interests were concerned, and so our attentions were focused domestically. There was quite a bit of the political issues of the day, primarily economic. What, the tariff, railroad rates, the West versus East? What were the major political issues of the time?
Well, so broadly speaking, and I'll talk about the detailed issues that they were fighting about. But broadly speaking, people were concerned about a lot of the same things that we're concerned about today. There was vast economic inequality between the haves and the have-nots. that was getting worse. People, the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting poorer. With the corporate influence in politics, many people, especially out in what they called the West back then, which included Wisconsin, what we call Midwest now, they were in rural areas. People felt that government was dominated by East Coast elites and that no control over it, and they were suffering from inflation, falling wages, and struggling to get by. So that was the biggest issue, certainly. There were also some other issues we're familiar with, like environmental degradation and economic instability. They had a huge financial panic, much worse than the one that we had just a few years ago.
Well, and it was we were in a real boom and bust economy throughout the post-Civil War period, even before that. There was no banking regulation. There was no Federal Reserve. There was no currency, monetary policy that was promulgated by the federal government. It was a completely different economic landscape. Certainly, let's talk about some of the players. We had the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, but I don't know how recognizable they would be in terms of somebody who just kind of stepped from that era to this with no transition. Who were the major powers politically of that time?
Well, so what's interesting is that what's interesting about this era is that the issues, the ideological issues, are very familiar to us. This is when you got the divide between progressives and conservatives when it really started up, and they didn't even use those words really to describe politics at that time. So the ideological divide was similar, but the parties were very different. Both parties were split between they had the conservatives who dominated the parties, particularly the Republican Party, and then you had these progressive insurgents who were pushing around the edges, and that was true in both parties. The parties themselves were not very different from one another ideologically. It tended to be more regional. The South, of course, was committed Democrat. The East was largely Republican, with the exception of the big cities. So the big cities had corrupt Democratic machines, most of them, like New York and Milwaukee and St. Louis and Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you had Democrats in the cities in the South and Republicans pretty much everywhere else, and that's what enabled the Republicans to be so dominant in the Reconstruction era and the Gilded Age, really from the Civil War through 1912, which is where my book ends. The Republicans really dominated government.
Mm-hmm. And there were also some differences in terms of how the House and Senate were viewed. The day I was interested to read, you described that there was a lot of thinking that our two-house system of our two-house legislative system ought to be thought of similar to the British Parliament, where you had the House of Commons, which would be the House of Representatives, sort of the people's house, direct elected, and then you had the Senate, which was sort of a House of Lords. And a lot of people don't remember, we didn't yet, at the time that your book talks about, we didn't yet have direct election of U.S. senators. Senators were chosen by state legislatures. That certainly played a role in how these two bodies operated, didn't it?
Yes, certainly. Many people aren't familiar with why the two bodies were defined in the way they were. The people, the framers, the constitutional framers, were really wanted an aristocracy. Men, because of course it was men of property, men of distinction. They wanted them to run the Senate, and then the House was more for the commoners. But we had no official aristocracy in the United States, so as a way of approaching the House of Lords, they decided to let the state governments elect the senators. And that was the original Constitution, and it worked out in some ways as the framers wanted to. The Senate was very rich. The critics at the time derided it as a millionaire's club. with the state legislatures being very corrupt, they often elected senators that the bosses wanted. One of the senators that I write about in the book, who's the major power in the Senate for some 20 years, was Senator Nelson Aldrich of Rhode Island. You know, we talked a moment before about how they would literally pay the voters of Rhode Island on who to vote for. And this guy, Nelson Aldrich, he didn't start off a rich man, but he worked his way up through the political system, and he got into the Senate. And, you know, before long, he ended up being a very rich man, in part through the favor of the Sugar Trust, which you know, we know its most famous brand is Domino Sugar. But Aldrich was pulling levers in the Senate on behalf of the Sugar Trust, and when he wanted to start a trolley company in Providence, they put up the money. And it was that trolley company that he really didn't even work for, just attached his name to it and smoothed the regulatory path to get it set up. That made him a millionaire. I think he was estimated to have $10 million, which was a tremendous sum at that time.
Yeah, a lot of money then. In fact, for someone like me, it's still a lot of money. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Michael Woodruff, I want to shift our focus to Wisconsin and Robert La Follette and how he got his start in politics, his background, and the things that he did in Wisconsin, and then how that kind of spread out from there across the country, and talk about the whole the birth of the progressive movement and what that did eventually to the Republican Party of that day. And want to invite our audience to participate as well. Here's the number to call, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. We'll continue our discussion with Michael Woolreich about his new book, Unreasonable Men, Theodore Roosevelt and the Republican Rebels Who Created Progressive Politics, in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about the progressive movement and its birth and its effect on the Republican Party of the early part of the 20th century. The book under discussion is Unreasonable Men, Theodore Roosevelt and the Republican Rebels Who Created Progressive Politics. Of course, one of those was our own Robert Fighting Bob La Follette. And we're talking with the author of this new book, Michael Woolreich. And Michael, let's talk about Bob La Follette. How did he get started in politics? What was his background, and how did he enter the political arena?
Well, he had, even as he said himself, a fairly ordinary start. He was at the University of Wisconsin as a student, and was thinking about going into acting, actually, and changed his mind when he was advised by a famous actor at the time that he was too short for the stage. He was only about 5'5", 5'6".
They'd never heard of Tom Cruise then, apparently.
Well, you know, the Hollywood's able to do wonders for height that didn't
right.
work on the stage.
No. So I'm sorry, I interrupted you. I apologize.
No, not at all.
So he was too short for the stage, and so he couldn't be an actor. So then what did he decide to try?
Well, so he was also an orator, and he would go around to different competitions. And, in fact, I believe it was in Iowa, although I could be getting that wrong, that he was very proud of, and decided to become a lawyer. He actually became a district attorney of Madison, which is his first job after law school. His story, as he tells it, was that he was fighting the machine even back then. That the as he describes it, there's the political boss had picked someone else. You had to do your time before you got selected by the machine to office. And La Follette was not the kind of guy who stood in line. He didn't like to be told what to do. He was very stubborn and very idealistic. And he felt that if he could win the election, he should be able to become district attorney. So he went around and got help from a number of Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin students. He also had a mentor who helped him out and was able to win that district attorney spot. So he served as district attorney for a few years and then decided he wanted to go to Washington and had a similar run-in with the machine where they didn't really, you know, he wasn't next in line, but he went around them and got elected to Congress. At this time, though, he was still not, he was idealistic, but not really ideological. He served in Congress as a fairly loyal Republican. You know, the machine overlooked his transgressions, and he served there for number of years in the 1870s and 1880s, but started to have friction with the big boss at the time, who was Philetus Sawyer, who was a senator and a lumber tycoon. And Sawyer would ask Bob to do certain favors for the lumber industry and the railroad industry, which were two of the biggest industries in Wisconsin at the time. And La Follette refused. They had a falling out, and one of Sawyer's deputies was heard to say that the quote, I believe, was if La Follette thinks he can buck the big railroad companies, we'll get him, or something along those lines. So he had this initial tension, but it still wasn't his birth as a progressive fighter had not begun, and he actually lost election when the Democrats swept the House and returned to Wisconsin, and that's when his political career really began.
Okay, so throughout his political life, La Follette had a kind of an interesting way to take a look at defeat. He didn't really care if he lost the current fight. He was in it for the long haul, and that was one of the things that he and Roosevelt really differed on. Was as we discussed, Roosevelt was considered himself a practical man. He wanted to get something done, even if it wasn't, you know, a perfect solution or didn't get everything he wanted. He didn't care as long as he got something done. You had La Follette, on the other hand, who was not interested in compromise. And he didn't care if he lost today's battle. He felt that if he kept fighting, that eventually he would prevail. Talk about how those viewpoints contrasted and how that affected the relationship that these two men eventually had.
Certainly. Well, let me add a little bit to the story, and so that I can answer that question. La Follette, once he returned to Wisconsin, this boss Sawyer tried to get him to influence a court case, and La Follette accused Sawyer of trying to bribe him. And for La Follette, that was the last straw. And then he decided he was no longer going to work within the machine. He was not he was not the kind of guy to go start a third party. He pretty much charged straight ahead. And so straight ahead for him was to destroy the Republican political machine and replace it with the kind of Republican Party that he believed in, the Party of Lincoln. And so he ran for governor. And this was unheard of to try to run as this insurgent from outside the system, you know, just a congressman, not in the machine. And he ran a candidate that he backed ran in three separate governor's races before they finally won the governor's seat. And he would do this by going out, using his oratorical skills, going out into the country where a lot of the bosses didn't go, and persuading people to his vision. Now, when he became governor, this is where you really see the difference between his style and Theodore Roosevelt's style. Both reformers, but Roosevelt, as we talked about, was a pragmatist. La Follette felt that there was no point in pushing for what he called half-a-loaf measures. These were bills that you might negotiate, but wouldn't actually do the job. They would just dull people's appetites, and nothing would really change. So La Follette had a different strategy. He would push the ambitious bill, knowing full well that it would never pass, in because there were still a number of his opponents in the Senate, knowing full well that these would, in the Wisconsin Senate, knowing that these bills would not pass, he would let them go down in defeat. And then, when Congress was no longer in session, at the next election, he would go around to all the towns that he'd been to before, and he would talk about the bill that he was trying to pass to regulate the railroad industry or to have more fair elections. And then he would read out the names of the legislators that had voted against the bill. And he would go down the list one at a time, you know, yay, nay. And as he got close to the name of the local legislator, people would start to tense up. They'd be waiting, and then he would say the name and say the nay vote, and then people would start hissing. Sometimes the representative was even right there, thinking, you know, he may have been a Republican, thinking that his own governor from his own party would never turn on him. And so La Follette used this strategy to get these legislators who opposed him, even legislators from his own party, so that they would lose in the next election. And then it wasn't until his first 4 years, because he refused to compromise, he didn't get much done as governor. But after that, he had basically cleaned out the opposition in Congress, and he was able to pass a number of very important legislation, a number of important laws, that turned Wisconsin into the most progressive state in the country.
Well, that's a key piece of Wisconsin's history, and there were a number of things that happened. The fight wasn't over when he became governor. Of course, the Republican Party bosses of the day didn't go quietly. They still had the legislature. As you point out, he wasn't able to get his legislative program adopted, but his insurgents, they were called half-breeds, I think, at the time, and the party bosses there, the stalwarts. That's right. It was the stalwarts and the half-breeds in Wisconsin. And there was, you tell a story about something that happened. It was a state convention that they met in the famous Red Gym here in Madison, and I've been there on a number of occasions. In fact, I was just sitting in a meeting there yesterday morning, and I had been reading your book, and I was looking at the Red Gym and trying to imagine what happened that even involved UW-Madison football players. I mean, this is it's a tremendous story. You could just tell this story just briefly, and then we'll continue our conversation, because it's just too good to skip.
Sure. I love this story. In fact, I was most of the book flowed pretty well, but I was really struggling with how to start the book. There's just what event would kick off everything that happened. And I knew the story, and I started thinking about it, started thinking about how I would tell it. And I just felt that this battle between the La Follette half-breeds and the conservative stalwarts at the Red Gym was just a great place to start it off. This was the beginning of the Republican insurgency that 8 years later would tear apart the party and forever change American politics. So what happened was, as this was when he had been governor for 4 years, there were 2-year terms, so he'd served 2 terms, all the while struggling with the stalwarts, as they called them, because people didn't use the word conservative or progressive at that time. So he's struggling with these stalwarts, trying to pass these big bills, and the stalwarts keep voting him down. So La Follette goes around, does his speeches, gets a majority of delegates to elect him for the third term. For the stalwarts, this is their last stand. They hate La Follette. They're all Republicans. They hate La Follette, and they want to bring him down. And so they decide there were a number of contested races, and the stalwarts said, okay, we're just going to bring everyone in to the Red Gym and just take the convention just by popular force. And La Follette and the half-breeds were ready for them. He got a bunch of Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin football players manning the door. They had a little barbed wire passageway that the delegates had to pass through. And the football players checked the credentials, some of which were forged. And if you didn't have proper credentials, the delegates didn't get in. So the Stalwarts' plan was foiled. They didn't get as many people as they wanted into the Red Gym. And the half-breeds had the majority, and they renominated Bob La Follette. At that point, the Stalwarts knew the game was done. They couldn't win at the Red Gym, so they jumped up, left the building, and decided to hold their own convention at the Opera House a few blocks away. So now all of a sudden you had two groups claiming to be the Republican Party of Wisconsin, and that was the beginning of the split.
Well, and that actually ended up having an impact at the National Republican Party Convention that year, because there was the question of credentialing, deciding which delegation from Wisconsin would be recognized. To no one's surprise, the National Party sided with the Stalwarts, and their delegates were seated. La Follette's delegates were not, as I understand.
That's correct. The Stalwarts' allies were in the National Party. There was even the chairman of the Republican National Committee was himself a Stalwart. Really, the half-breeds never had a chance. They tried to get Roosevelt to help them. They sent delegations, but Roosevelt didn't like La Follette. He didn't like La Follette's style. He worried he was too radical. He worried that all this, you know, the turmoil in Wisconsin was going to, you know, affect his own election chances in winning the state, and he didn't want anything to do with it. So he said, "Sorry, I can't help you. You're on your own." And they lost at the convention. The Wisconsin Supreme Court later decided in their favor, and so the half-breeds won out in the end.
Why were they called the half-breeds? Where did that come from? I mean, that's kind of a racial epithet.
It was half breed, as in half Republican. So I don't think it was ever intended to be racial. It was a really reference. You know, the journalists were searching around for, you know, well, how do you describe these people? And there had been an earlier battle in, you know, dating back to Ulysses S. Grant, an earlier battle over slightly different matters in the Republican Party, and those labels had arrived then. Half breed being half Republican. These were the reformers, and the Stalwarts were the ones who wanted to keep things just the way they were. Mm-hmm. So they used these terms to describe La Follette's group versus the old guard. It would be La Follette himself, actually, who later started using the term progressive to describe and his politics.
And that was some years after that. He became known as Fighting Bob. And who gave him that nickname? How did that come about?
Actually, I don't know the answer to that one.
Okay.
I didn't find a point in which somebody coined the name. There were, you know, early on there were, you know, a few different names. The Little Giant, some people called him, and I think Fighting Bob had a ring to it, and that's the one that would go down in history.
Journalism of the time, we had the Yellow Press. Later on, the nickname Muckraker was applied to a number of investigative journalists, as some of whom most journalists had a political agenda at that time. Newspapers were openly allied with one political group or another. There was one publication that you talk about in your book that had the reputation for objective journalism and solid investigative technique and so forth. And then you had Sinclair Lewis was writing his books. He was a socialist, but he did cause quite a stir and cause quite a bit of uproar about the meatpacking industry. You tell that story in the book. But talk a little bit about the press of the day. And where they figured in all this political talk. Because I think one of the things maybe some of us have a little trouble understanding is why it took so long for people to really discover what was going on politically. It sounds to me like until La Follette came out and read the roll call, people didn't really have any way to know how their member of Congress or their member of the state legislature voted. And for those of us who live in the age of the instant information online and entire channels on cable television being devoted to everything Congress does, it maybe seems a little mind-boggling. What was the media landscape like at that time?
Well, as you said, one issue is that many of the papers were owned by one of the two major parties, by the Republican Party, Democratic Party. Even the Socialist Party had its papers. There were others. There was the Yellow Press that were more like tabloids today. But there was a new type of magazine that came around at this time that Theodore Roosevelt, you know, derogatively actually coined the term muckraker. They were investigative magazines, one of which, the most famous one, was McClure's magazine, and that's the one that Ida Tarbell and Lincoln Steffens and Ray Stannard Baker, all the famous early investigative journalists, all worked for McClure's. And they were, we would call them political today, but people didn't think of them as political because the word political meant you were with one party or the other, and they didn't care about the party. They cared about the state of the country, and they cared about, you know, what was going wrong and what to do about it. And so they were very influential in reporting some of the abuses, particularly the corporate abuses and the trust abuses that were happening at the time. A lot of they wrote about political corruption, and so it was one of these, Lincoln Steffens, who I don't want to say he discovered La Follette, but he wrote this article about La Follette that really gave him national prominence.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that kind of surprised me was your description of how they went about getting their stories. I was amazed at how willing people were to talk about their own misdeeds. Like they didn't really have an understanding that this person is here to write a story. This is going to be in a magazine. That was just kind of mind-blowing.
I was also struck by that. I think partly they didn't, you know, this is before the internet age. It wasn't, you know, you didn't, even if it wasn't a magazine, you didn't really know how it would affect you. The other thing is that, you know, with politics done behind closed doors, it didn't really matter that much. The press could write what it wanted, but if you were, you know, if you ran the machine, people didn't recognize the power of the press really have such a great political influence. So I suspect these are some of the reasons. Some of it also was just Lincoln Steffens was just very good at getting people to talk.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we need to fast forward because, this book reads like it's kind of like reading the play-by-play to a really exciting sports competition. I mean, there's just so much intrigue, and there's so much stuff going on in here. It's like a really good mystery novel. I had trouble putting it down, which is one reason I didn't necessarily get enough sleep last night. But I don't want to go through, you know, we're not going to have time to go through this thing page by page. So I want to jump ahead a little bit and talk about, when we come back, how the progressive movement eventually led to a huge split in the Republican Party and how that in turn allowed Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, to become president of the United States and led to some sweeping changes in the national legislature as a result of that and what eventually became of the progressive movement and Bob La Follette. We'll take some calls if anybody would like to join us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. My guest is Michael Woolreich. He is the author of the book under discussion this hour, Unreasonable Men. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the birth of the progressive movement, fighting Bob La Follette, Teddy Roosevelt, and that whole thing from the early part of the 20th century. The book under discussion, Unreasonable Men, Theodore Roosevelt and the Republican Rebels Who Created Progressive Politics. Michael Woolreich is the author of that book, and he is my guest this hour. So we have fighting Bob La Follette. He becomes governor of Wisconsin. Then he gets himself the legislature he wants and gets appointed U.S. senator, and so he's on the national stage now as a senator. He's the junior senator from the state of Wisconsin, and let's talk a little bit about La Follette's Senate career. But more importantly, how is it that the progressive movement grew so rapidly in terms of movements of that day? It rapidly grew across the country and eventually became a major political force and led to the downfall of Republican dynasty of that time. So Bob La Follette is in the Senate. Take it from there.
Sure. So he arrives in the Senate, and he's you know the press is mocking him. The his Republican colleagues are snubbing him, and even President Theodore Roosevelt, who had similar reform ideas, doesn't want to talk to him because Bob La Follette was you know too radical for him. And this tempestuous relationship that he had with Roosevelt, because he did meet with him a number of times. And it was just it was oil and water. The Roosevelt was trying to get legislation passed. He saw La Follette as getting in the way with his, because La Follette kept pushing these ambitious bills that would never pass. Roosevelt would have a railroad bill, and La Follette would say, "Oh, it doesn't go far enough," and he would try to attach amendments to them, and they would get shot down. And Roosevelt just couldn't understand it. He thought La Follette was just making a name for himself, and he was particularly annoyed when La Follette embarked on one of his famous filibusters. He broke Senate records with his filibusters and was filibustering a finance bill that Senator Aldrich, who was from Rhode Island, who we were talking about, was trying to push. And this filibuster failed, and Theodore Roosevelt thought it was a big waste of time, but it was all part of La Follette's strategy because it got him tremendous press. And got not just him, but his ideas. And these valiant stands attracted people to his cause, even if, in the short run, they went down in defeat.
And then he employed tactics similar to the ones that he used to get a different legislature in Wisconsin. He went around the country and spoke at this was the day of the Chautauqua, the tent that would be set up. Politicians would come and speak, orators would come and speak, musicians would perform, people would read poetry and so forth, and farmers and others came from miles around to spend several days at these Chautauqua events. Talk about how La Follette used the roll call and speaking at these Chautauqua events to maybe strike a little fear into the hearts of some of the politicians of his day.
So exactly, La Follette did just what he had done in Wisconsin. Instead of going around just around the rural areas of Wisconsin, now he was going across the entire country and talking about the bills and the amendments that he was trying to pass, and how the conservatives in Congress opposed them and shot them down. And he would read out the names of everyone who voted for the bill and everyone who voted against it. Just as before, he was going after members of his own party, and he would actually back primary challengers and echo what might sound familiar to us from the Republican Party today. He was pushing, he would support these primary challengers against the Republican establishment. And some of them lost, and some of them won. And soon he had a few allies in Congress, people who had won election on his progressive platform. Then you had some other senators who were already in Congress start to. Some of them were concerned about their own constituency. Some were persuaded by his ideas and persuaded by the possibility of achieving his ideas, and they came over to his side. So all of a sudden, it wasn't just Bob La Follette, this boogeyman of the Senate anymore. He now had a real faction, and it was that faction. Nothing had really changed yet, but by the time Roosevelt left office, there was a sizable faction in Congress.
Mm-hmm. So Roosevelt leaves, Taft comes in, and in the off-year election, I think it was 1910, a tectonic shift in control of Congress and in a lot of state houses. That was a Democratic wave year, much like the Republican wave that we saw in 2010. What led to the stunning turnaround? The Republicans had been firmly in the driver's seat, and up till that point looked like they were going to stay there. What was it that produced their downfall?
I don't think it was a Democratic wave. I think it was a progressive wave. The La Follette's faction did not lose many races. It was the conservative Republicans who lost races, and similarly, many of the conservative Democrats lost races. So all of a sudden, starting with 1910, and then really in 1912. The conservative power bloc that had dominated Congress for decades and maintained a chokehold on any kind of reform legislation all of a sudden they were gone. And so once you had, when you had Wilson as president, then all of a sudden you had this bipartisan alliance of progressive Republicans and progressive Democrats who passed all these very important legislation, from the first federal income tax to the Federal Reserve to women's suffrage to antitrust laws and labor regulations. All of this happened that had not happened during Roosevelt's administration or in the decades before that, all of a sudden happened in just a brief 4 years of Wilson's first term.
Yeah, and Wilson is another interesting character in this, too, because he successfully fought off the party bosses in New Jersey. That's also kind of an interesting side story to all of this, is how he kind of came up and went against the grain and was able to use his own powers of persuasion to defeat party bosses in New Jersey. That's kind of an interesting story. So La Follette's in the Senate, and progressives from both parties are being elected. Then all of a sudden we have Teddy Roosevelt comes back from hunting in Africa and decides maybe he'd like to be president again. Talk us through how we got to the whole bull moose fiasco.
Right. So this is before 1912, you still had, the Democrats had captured the House, but they did not control the Senate, and their majority in the House is fairly small. And there still was Taft, this Republican president, who had become increasingly conservative in Roosevelt's absence. And so the La Follette wants to lead this progressive movement that he's nurtured. He wants to lead it and run against Taft for the Republican nomination. And he starts campaigning, and he's struggling but getting some attention. And then Theodore Roosevelt comes back, and Theodore Roosevelt is a very political animal. He wasn't calculating. He embodied politics, really. And so I think even without thinking, he understood innately how the country was changing and how this progressive movement was sweeping the country. And he started adopting La Follette's more aggressive, ambitious tactics, and started calling himself a progressive, which was the first time. He never used that word to describe himself during his presidency. He used it after he came back in 1911, most notably at his famous New Nationalism speech in Kansas. When he saw what Taft was doing, and he saw La Follette faltering, he resisted, and finally he said, "My hat's in the ring. I'm running for president." That infuriated La Follette. La Follette still didn't trust him as a genuine progressive. You know, saw him felt that he had been used as a stalking horse, and that basically Roosevelt was just going to sweep in and take his supporters away from him, which is pretty much what happened.
Hmm. Well, you know, we're about out of time. What do you think? What's the number one takeaway you would have people get from this book you've written?
So one of the things that fascinated me about this insurgency in the Republican Party is that it didn't follow intuition. It was counterintuitive. You would think that if you want to accomplish political change, the way to do it is the pragmatic way, and you know, you compromise, you take incremental steps,
work within the system,
and that may be work within the system, and that may work in some contexts and some of the time. But when you have an entrenched power that is essentially shutting that down and refusing to allow any kind of change, sometimes the best solution is to go big, to look at the long game, to run policies that will go down in defeat, and use that to ultimately defeat the obstruction.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it. Michael Woolreich, thank you for an interesting book and an interesting hour.
Thank you so much, John.
The book is Unreasonable Men, Theodore Roosevelt and the Republican Rebels Who Created Progressive Politics. This program was produced by KP Whaley, on-air production by Cynthia Schuster and Dave Potratz. Thanks for their help today. Kathleen is back tomorrow. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.